Well, sisters, we'll finish this seminar on the Eucharist by talking about three modern, well, they're both, the modern, broadly speaking, but post-Reformation Thomist theories of the real presence of Christ's passion, or the effects of Christ's passion, in the sacrifice of the Mass. How is it that the sacrifice of Calvary acts upon us and upon the Church, or elevates the life of the Church into the self-offering of Christ in and through the sacrifice of the Mass? And I'm going to look at three different theories. Unfortunately, a lot of this little class will just involve reading texts and commenting on them, but it just helps focus, you know, so that we get our mind around these different three theories. So the first one I'm going to talk about, we could call it representation and application, a classical Dominican interpretation. You will remember that in the one article that Aquinas did write on the sacrifice of the Mass that we looked at yesterday afternoon, he talks about the fact that it's for two reasons a sacrifice, because it represents mystically, ontologically, because of the real distinctiveness of the double consecration. God changes the bread into the body of Christ and the wine into the blood of Christ. It represents mystically and ontologically the separation of the body and blood of Christ at Calvary. So that's one reason it's a sacrifice. And the other is then it effectuates in us, or it transmits to us, communicates to us, the graces of the passion of Christ. Well, this is the classic theory, is to focus on that article as the kind of core explanation. And you'll find this in a modern person like Guérigou Lagrange, but you find earlier treatments of it in different ways in John of St. Thomas and in Cardinal Cajetan. And they do argue principally from that question 83, Article 1. The Eucharist is a sacrifice because it represents the one true sacrifice of the cross, and it applies the fruits of the cross to our lives. That's to say, the graces that were merited by the suffering and death of Christ. Now, you know, that's elegant, it's to the point, and it certainly would save the doctrine of the sacrifice of the Mass of the Council of Trent, in the sense that you can say the Eucharist is a true sacrifice. It's not a, you know, it's this certainly is not a minimalist view, because it does teach us that the graces of the sacrifice of Calvary operate or are present in and through the mystery of the sacrifice of the Mass, and they allow us to offer to the Father the merits of Christ's passion. And they affect in us the graces of the Passion, so that we, the Church, can offer our lives to God in Christ for the glory of the Father and for the salvation of the world, under the influences of the merits of Christ.
How are they interpreting the word represent?
Well, represents here is, again, deeper than just symbolizes. It's a symbolism that is given to us by God's own act of the double consecration.
We can translate make present.
It's true. Journée translates representatio as renders present, which I don't think is an accurate translation. I mean, I think that the idea that renders present the sacrifice of the Mass is stronger, the sacrifice of the cross is stronger than this representatio permits. That's a disputed... So Journée tries to interpret the representatio as renders present, and I think it's more of a medieval notion of represents, is what we would say in English, represents. Now, it's more than just a symbolic making present. It's rendering present through the symbolism of the double consecration, which, as we say, involves this very special action of God. But I don't think the representation in question is the same thing as saying that Aquinas is saying it renders present the event of the cross. Journée goes more and more this direction. In his book that I suggested, he talks about the substantial presence of, we'll come to his position, but he talks about the substantial presence of the glorified Christ and the operative presence of Calvary. So he says, who is rendered present? Now, Christ is rendered present as now glorified by transubstantiation, but the graces of the Passion are, you know, poured out upon the Church operatively, so there's a kind of operative presence of the cross. And he's pushing to kind of say that this in a certain way renders present Calvary to us. As he goes on in life, he changes his position, which I didn't tell you, it's not in the reading, but he changes his position to that of Maritans, which we're about to look at. So his later position is stronger, that in some way the transubstantiation renders present in some way the real event of Calvary. So he finishes with a stronger position. More peculiar. Under the influence of Maritain. They write about it in their letters with each other now in about, 7 or 9 volumes. They write about it in their letters together from the time they first started their correspondence, which is thousands of pages, to the end of their life. It keeps coming up. They were both obsessed with this question the whole of their lives. It's very interesting. There's no grace that we can receive that isn't also already in the Virgin Mary. Now, there are potential risks with this first view, okay? So you could run it in a direction that could be, I would argue, maybe dangerously a bit minimalist. So, Coleman O'Neill is a very gifted, great sacramental theologian from Fribourg. He's Irish in the 20th century. And he's got this book, Sacramental Realism, that has a lot of, it's excellent. It's worth reading. But there's a passage here that I raise questions about. So listen to this. When we turn to the action of Christ in the Eucharist, the distinction between priest and victim disappears, since what Christ offered and offers is himself, now that he is risen, all must be reduced to his love and to his submission to the Father, always in favor of his members. Now that's that idea of a continuity of love, like the love with which Christ offered himself to the Father, continues to perdure in heaven, and the Eucharist in its sacrifice of the Mass conforms us to the love of Christ in glory. Indeed, since it is the risen Christ who is active in the Eucharist, it is only by straining the sense of the word to the point of near ambiguity that we may speak of his sacrificing at all. In a few words, what is being suggested here as an adequate account of the doctrine of Eucharistic sacrifice is as follows. The symbolism of the Eucharist, the double consecration representing the Passion, contains the glorious Christ worshiping the Father and unites the faithful's spiritual sacrifice to his worship, not only as he exists now, but also as he existed in his Passion and death, since the Pilgrim Church must pass through for itself those mysteries which for him are accomplished. Right? So what he's saying is, he's basically putting all the weight of the Eucharistic sacrifice on our conformity to the love which Christ has for the Father. And so it's not really the activity of the sacrifice of the Passion acting on us now, because that event is terminated, but it's the grace of Christ in glory. And so therefore the only way that the cross really acts on us is in a certain way. It seems to me that it turns towards saying the cross acts on us now uniquely by way of merit, which is still important, but he merited our salvation, and now he gives us the grace merited for us in his glorified state, conforming us to the love he has for the Father, as opposed to sort of like what we'll see with Journet is saying the operative act of the cross works in the world. Okay, so there's different ways to read this first position, and O'Neill has one interpretation. You could interpret it kind of very much in the sense of Journet and end up something very close to the third position I'm going to give you. Sometimes when I present this stuff to my students, they say, the first position and the third position deep down are really the same, or they're deeply compatible. And I'm not sure what I think about that. But because you're going to see, I'm going to advocate the third position myself. But all right, so here's the second position. The Eucharist is the real presence of the historical sacrifice of Calvary. Now, I typically make my Dominican students write an essay on what they think about this. And I have occasionally had one of them defend this second position. And one of them, who did so very ardently, left the Dominicans to become a Carthusian monk. He's still there. So that might be a kind of a very strained argument for its truth. But anyway... Anyway, so this position would be held, historically it's associated with De Soto, but is a Thomist, but Maritain definitely takes an unambiguous argument of this line. His whole life he's convinced of this. And when he goes to Mass, he's in the real presence of the event of Calvary, or he's communing with, he's joining himself to the very crucifixion of Jesus. And he's trying to find a way to talk about that. And at the end of his life, he wrote an essay, a rather protracted one. It's in English, the translation of the book is Untrammeled Pathways, I think. It's something like Voix sans, I forget the name of the book. But it's in the 13th volume of the collected works. He has a later, if you Google this, he has a later essay on the sacrifice of the Mass. It's translated into English, although this is not from that translation. I just translated from the French. Okay, so here he says, this is just a nutshell summary in a core paragraph. Divine omnipotence makes it such that the sphere of that day of the past, which was the today of Good Friday, and which as pertains to the duration of events in this world, no longer exists, but which is always present to divine eternity, and which is imperishably conserved in it, comes to touch the sphere of this day of present time, which is today, where I hear the Mass said. Right, so did you get that? He's saying the event of the past no longer exists, but in some way the sphere, think in an image there of a sphere, the sphere of the events of Calvary is preserved by the divine eternity and is rendered present to us in the Mass. Thus, in the double consecration, we are really, albeit invisibly, rendered present at the sacrifice of Calvary, and the sacrifice of Calvary is rendered present to us, really, albeit invisibly. Now he's going backwards and forth. Am I going back to what happened already, or is what already happened coming to me? I mean, because he's saying it's in some ways he's saying, you know, to God in his eternity all things are always present. God can preserve a certain moment of the life of Christ in his humanity, as it were, present to divine eternity forever, and render that present to us in the Mass. He is there, est nunc, to be offered today on the earth in a non-bloody way, by Jesus glorified, and by the priest as his instrumental agent here below, and by us, spiritually united to the priest, as he was offered in a bloody way on Good Friday by the Christ nailed to the cross. And he goes on, sometimes all he means by the unbloody and bloody is it's now an unbloody representation, because you don't have to shed blood to represent it, of the one bloody sacrifice, so that what's present on the altar is the one bloody sacrifice of Calvary, present under unbloody representations. And notice he says there that not only do we offer the one crucified Christ, but that the glorified Christ, through the instrumentality of the priest, offers the crucified Christ. So there you see the tension in that position, right? To be really present as the substantial Christ suffering Golgotha raises the question of what's the relationship between the really present Christ suffering Golgotha, rendered present by the omnipotence of God, and the really present glorified Christ. Right? There's not two Jesuses. And you can say things, yeah, but God, Jesus is God in his eternity. He can kind of preserve all of his states of life, right? Okay, but is Jesus also now also still 2 years old? Or, now you can tell me about St. Anthony and the Madonna holding out like the baby Jesus. And I'm willing to believe that things like that have happened, but I don't think that the Lord, in his perpetual life of perpetually glorified life, just is now experiencing what it was to be an infant still in his humanity. I don't think he has an infant humanity, a crucified humanity, a glorified humanity. At least let me pose to you that those are the I was educated in this view of Maritain. And these questions have arisen for me as problems that have made me move away from the idea of the preservation in God of different temporal states of the sacred humanity of Jesus. The attractiveness, of course, of it is that when you celebrate Christmas, you're in the real presence of Christ born of the Virgin Mary. And when you're in celebrating Easter, Good Friday, the church celebrates the real presence of Christ crucified and so forth. And so the transfiguration. Now, I do believe you can say that. So that's why Adam Odo Cassell wanted to say, good Benedictine that he was, that the church has kind of a real experience of the mysteries of the life of Jesus. And I do think there's something to that, but I don't think you want to preserve it in eternity different states of being of the historical chronological life of Jesus in his humanity. What I think you want to say is those states have already taken place and they no longer take place in the life of the glorified Christ. But based on those texts we looked at yesterday, like 56:1, those historical states, all that Christ did and suffered, effectuate grace, have an effect on us through the humanity of Jesus. to the instrumentality of the humanity of Jesus. And then now, by the divine power and the spiritual contact of the divine power with the church, God can give us the grace to allow the transfiguration of Christ that took place then to have an effect in our lives now. God can allow the birth of Christ, the nativity of Jesus on Christmas night, when we celebrate it in the liturgy, to have an effect on our lives now. And there is a way in which that effect gives us a connatural knowledge of those mysteries. Like, we grow in our understanding of the mystery of Christmas on Christmas night. We commune with the graces of that mystery. The mystery is no longer existing in heaven, but the graces from that event are given to us in such a way that we really do understand something of what that mystery is, or, you know, what it was and what it means, what it tells us about God. So this is a middle position. It allows you to say that those mysteries still have an effect on us, that they still reveal to us who God is. And so those, what Christ did and suffered, still has a kind of eternal presence to us, but it's an operative presence, in Journay's language, it's an operative presence. Those things continue to operate upon us. It's not a substantial presence, because Christ is no longer being born in the cave. But what Christ, who was born in the cave, that event continues to have a kind of operative effect on the church through the operative graces of Christ that continue to effectuate a connaturality between ourselves and Christ in his historical life. All that he lived and suffered continues to affect us and connaturalize us to the life of Christ in accordance with his graces as man. But he as man is no longer living those sets of events that were constitutive of his human life.
What exactly then is in eternity, God sees everything as present?
That's true. God knows all the past events as present, and that's one of the reasons they can have effect on our life. But my fear would be collapsing the humanity of Christ into his divinity. I mean, in his human, I mean, there's always an eternal distinction. Christ, God is always human. The Son is always human forever. But the humanity is always a true natural humanity. And so it seems to me the fact that Christ as God in his eternal wisdom has present to himself all that Christ has lived and suffered for us means that God in his eternal power can render us conformed to those mysteries. But God as man has a kind of set of finite experiences and has only suffered once the Paschal mystery, and now lives in glory in his humanity. So I'm worried about losing the humanity. You know, you can always, there's plenty of danger of forgetting the divinity of Christ, but there's also risks with this kind of theory of minimalizing the integrity of his humanity and kind of collapsing it into eternalizing it in a divine way. So that's an old argument, actually. Strangely, Lutherans and Reformed Calvinists have a big argument about this, because the Lutherans will argue things like Christ's humanity is omnipresent because of the hypostatic union. He must be present everywhere as man. And the Calvinists say, no, you're not remembering the distinction of the natures. And it seems to me, actually, on this point, that Calvinists often they've read Aquinas, and they're closer to Aquinas on this point. But it's an interesting question. All right, so, you know, look, this is this is deeply mysterious, and there is not a settled opinion. If you read Ecclesia de Eucharistia of John Paul II, you will find he sounds a lot like this second position. Okay? So, I mean, that's just to say, there's definitely important people who've thought otherwise. Just continuing on here, we're going to come to the last position, which I've already kind of articulated. The contemporary effect of a past event. Instrumentality and spiritual contact by means of divine eternity and divine omnipotence. The past event is instrumental for our salvation and can affect us in the present by spiritual contact due to the divine eternity. Now, these theologians appeal to Aquinas' notion of the divine virtue, virtus, or power, the virtus divinitatis, as what we might call the medium, the formal medium, that by virtue of which, or through which, the temporal effects of Christ can reach all times and places by their effects, by virtual contact, contactus virtualis. These are Latin words of Aquinas in these questions we've been reading. How do the historical events of the Passion, Death, Resurrection, and Ascension act upon us now, attain to us now, by virtue of the divinity of Christ, through the medium of his divine power, which was present in those historical events, and which acts now to apply these mysteries to our life and to conform our lives to these mysteries. So here, Journet, in his, you know, mature but not late position, which is, you know, the book on the sacrifice of the Mass represents his mature views, although, as I've said, he sort of changes his views in his later life. Journet distinguishes between the operative presence of the cross in the sacrifice of the Mass and the substantial presence of the glorified Christ in order to interpret that famous question, 56, Article 1, Response 3, that I read yesterday, about how the spiritual contact of the past mysteries. And this is a quote from the English edition, page 61. At the Mass, there is, under the appearances of bread and wine, the substantial presence of Christ now glorious. And there is, under the same appearances, the efficient operative presence of his one redemptive sacrifice. Not without reason does Christ now glorious come to us under the appearances of his body given for us and his blood poured out for the remission of sins. It is in order to signify that he comes to us with the application, the contact, the power, and the presence of his one redemptive sacrifice. Now see, he is not saying there that the crucified Christ is substantially present, but that the glorified Christ has comes to us or renders himself present to us to effectuate in our lives the operative effects of his passion. Now, a strong argument that this is a right reading of Aquinas. I mean, the strong argument for the second position is to call that Christus Passus language. The crucified Christ, if you read it as the crucified Christ is present in the Eucharist. But the strong argument on this one is all that stuff about concomitance on Good Friday versus now. Like, if you'd celebrated the Mass on Good Friday, you would have had the substantial presence of, when you consecrate the body, the blood, no blood, just the body of Christ and just his divinity, but no soul or no blood because of the real separation. So I said, what you get is the substantial presence of Christ as he is, but now he's alive in the resurrection. So now when you celebrate the Mass, you have the real presence of the body, blood, soul, and divinity. Even when you have the formal effect of just the body, by concomitancy of the blood, the soul, and divinity. Because what you get is the substantial presence of Christ in his actual state. It's really hard to hold that view and refuse what Journet is saying here. Is that substantially you have the presence of the Christ in glory. How else could Aquinas affirm what he affirms about concomitance if that weren't the case? Right, so that's a strong argument. I'm just going to pose that as a point of petition. What can be argued about now or in the life to come. All right, now, he goes on to say in pages 66 through 67, we said that with respect to God, the redemptive act of the cross is in no way something of the past, but is always present. Right, so here he kind of turns the other direction. He says, but that I'm not saying that the past event is not present. It subsists perpetually in the divine acceptance, not in the condition of a memory, but in the condition of an actual object of vision. I mean, God knew it in its presentiality from all eternity. Right? So the sacrifice of Christ is eternally present to God in the divine eternity. That's true. That's, I think, got to be held unquestionably in some way. Okay. With respect to us and the things of this world, the redemptive act is simultaneous and under two different aspects. That's also got to be correct. Right? God, from all eternity, in his eternally present now, knows both Calvary and knows us now. If you hold a Thomist view of divine eternity, a Boethian and Thomist view of divine eternity, which is a very beautiful, true metaphysical view. Okay. In time, if we consider the sensible reality, is a transitory moment in the life of Christ. Outside of time, as say in the divine eternity, if we consider its spiritual redemptive power, whence its power to redeem and to reconcile by contact not only the world, which is contemporary with it, but all times to come. I'm not sure I copied that sentence down exactly right, but you see the point. You're saying it's eternally present. What Christ lived is eternally present to God in his divine knowledge and love, his wisdom, just as what we live now is eternally present to God in the same eternal now. And God, by his divine power, who was active in redeeming the world in the Paschal mystery of Christ, can act is also active now in the eternal present that is God's life. He's active to give us the very graces that he wished to give us. He wished to be effectuated in us by virtue of the cross. But what he's not saying here, what he's not saying is that the actual state, the state of being of Christ crucified is preserved per se substantially through time by virtue of the divine eternity. What he is saying is it's known from all eternity in the eternal now that is God and the presentiality of the eternity of God. And that same eternal knowledge of God has the omnipotence, the power as God to act, to effectuate in us what the cross accomplished for us. Now that seems to me a very good rendering of Aquinas on divine eternity and on the virtus divinitatis, of the instrumentality of all that Christ did and suffered in the past.
And that would, the Immaculate Conception, that would be,
yes, in another way. I mean, the cross wouldn't have, again, we wouldn't want to say the cross is substantially present when the Virgin Mary is conceived, but we would want to say that the graces given to the Virgin Mary by God from all eternity are given to her in light of God's eternally present knowledge of the graces that will be merited for us by Christ crucified. That's definitely connected. I mean, there's some parallel thought there. All right, so now just to finish, I find this author, Damien Fondal, he was a Central Province Dominican, I believe, in the middle of the 20th century. He wrote this book, short, excellent book, The Essence of the Eucharistic Sacrifice. This book has a lot of texts of Aquinas, and he tries to build up a case on this difficult issue. I sent a PDF to Sister Benedict. Okay, well, I mean, Fondal's got another, you know, he takes another crack at it, and it's different than Journet, but largely overlaps. And he writes, this is a long paragraph, but it's a nice way to kind of underscore this third view. But since the acts of Christ's human nature have ceased to exist secundum se in themselves, the act of crucifixion Christ is no longer being crucified. The contact of mankind with those acts can no longer be corporeal. Now, no efficient cause, however great its competency, is able to operate in distans, you know, in metaphysical separation. That's just some way that a cause affects you in an immediate way, if it's a true cause, if it's an efficient cause. And hence, some contact with the salvific actions of Christ are required if they are to be effective in the individual case. In accounting for this contact, St. Thomas repeatedly teaches that a spiritual contact is sufficient because the principal cause of the effects of Christ's passion in men's souls is not the passion itself, nor the corporeal nature of the God-man, you know, being crucified, but God himself in his deity, in his divinity. And for the exercise of God's causality, no corporeal contact is required. We don't have to actually touch the event of the crucifixion physically. Since on the one hand, all things are simultaneously present to God in his eternity, and on the other hand, being an omnipotent agent, he can endow his instruments with a power exceeding their natural capabilities. Even Jesus' human natural actions, there's no natural human capacity in them to affect all times and places. But because they are the natural actions of God, and God can in his eternal presentiality wish that they have an effect in all times and places, therefore these natural actions of Jesus accomplished for us can effectuate, they can have real effects rendered present in all times and places. This spiritual contact is realized through faith in the sacraments of faith, just as the human nature of the God-man, acting as a conjoined instrument of the Word, attains to all times and places in virtue of his divine power. So also sacraments, operating as separated instruments of Christ's human nature, but being ultimately subordinated to the divine causality, are effective in all times and places through the divine power. Thus the sacraments are but applications or terminations, we mean they are terminations in the sense of places that the power of Christ terminates or it is achieved, or consummations, of the passion in the individual faithful. And if there's not corporeal contact between the passion and the sacramental instruments, the spiritual contact between the two is sufficient because they operate in virtute divinitatis, by the power of the divinity. Now, you can just hear that that's a very closely scripted commentary on the passages we read yesterday. And then he talks about the term Christus Pastus. He's taking on an interpretation of the term which would most strongly avail the second option of Maritain, that the very event of Christ crucified, or the very event of Golgotha's presence on the altar, which again, is a permissible view. He says here, the full meaning of what St. Thomas intends by the term Christus Pastus, however, is not fully apparent unless the eternal value of Christ's victimhood is brought to the fore. Accordingly, to conclude this analysis of his teaching on the Eucharistic sacrifice, it is necessary to examine the following conclusions, which may be established from the angelic doctor's theology. First, although the body and blood of Christ are present in the Eucharist only substantially, yet in the consecration of the chalice, they are signified as being contained in the state of victimhood acquired in the Passion. That's like journée. Substantially, you have the glorified Christ present, but he's present under the signs of his victimhood, his paschal mystery. Consequently, Christ's body and blood, as signified in the consecration of the blood, are present in the Eucharist with the eternal value of victimhood obtained in the Passion. Now, the value, that's merit language. The one who's present, the Christus Pastus, is present as the glorified Christ is present as the one who has suffered in such a way as to merit our salvation. Thirdly, then, hence, the Eucharist is an immolation of Christ inasmuch as, through the eternal value of victimhood, which his Eucharistic body and blood contain, the fruits of the Passion are communicated to the faithful. Now there you see Damien Fondal saying something very similar to the first position. What's rendered present is the substantial presence of Christ in his glory. He's rendered present under the representatio of the double consecration, that's to say, under the signs of victimhood. This is to signify that the eternal Christ present, the glorified Christ who is rendered present has merited for us our salvation, but also to signify that in and through the performance of the Mass, the graces that he merited for us through his Passion are communicated to the faithful, representation and application. What it adds to that account of representation and application is the kind of explanation that happens by the Virtus Divinitate, because of the eternal presence of God in his power to convey to us that which God intended to give to us when God himself, in his human nature, lived and suffered these mysteries and willed as man to communicate to us by his power as God what he himself, some participation in his very mysteries, including his mystery of death and resurrection. We have not solved the mystery. We have indicated some parameters for thinking about it and presented some different theories for how to understand it. Reflection on it is necessary, but never adequate, because it has to be conjoined with our own contemplation of the mystery, our docility to the Holy Spirit in prayer, and our asking the Holy Spirit for enlightenment. I have myself come to believe this third explanation is at the heart of what's really happening, but the Eucharistic sacrifice is a profound mystery, and it is one that we should continue to kind of remain vulnerable to intellectually, not only spiritually, but also intellectually thinking about for the duration of our religious lives.